KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Robert Larson, closing out the rabbit hole from the previous hour, and we're now in the aggressive moderate hour, but actually I'm just going to let out the rabbit hole bleed over into, because I'm filling in for the vacationing Will Bruzzo, and my guest from out the rabbit hole, Daniel Pinchbeck, has graciously agreed to stay over with us a bit, and we're talking about his fascinating book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. And we just heard there on the little break, that was some music from the CD, Yahe Pinta, Psychedelic Shaman Songs of Santiago Mutumba Hoy. I believe that's the pronunciation. Daniel, you still with us?
I'm here, yeah. I thought that was Coldplay.
You thought it was what?
I thought that was Coldplay. Wasn't that? No.
Actually, it is, no. But yeah, had you heard that particular CD?
No, I haven't heard that one, but that was a very nice, typical kind of ayahuasca song.
Okay, from you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they actually, I think most of the ayahuasca music, tribal music, it's not even in tribal language. They actually are just making kind of sounds, like spirit language, you know. And when I did the work with the Sequoia in Ecuador, you know, we sort of lay in these hammocks all night, and they would sing. And the music was really like a navigation device. It would sort of guide the journeys. And they would actually stop at different points to kind of make sure that they were all like having similar visions and like seeing the blue people or the heavenly people or something. So the music is like a powerful technology during the ayahuasca experience.
Yeah, I've heard that before, and so let's make sure people understand this, because it's pretty weird, actually, and that you all have had the drink of the ayahuasca, or the yahe, as it's sometimes referred to, and you're having the visions, and the shaman is doing these songs, these sort of chants, and the visions that you all are having are actually altered by whatever he is singing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, that's true for, I mean, I would imagine that anybody who as a kid took LSD and went to a Grateful Dead show, you know, is aware of how powerful, you know, music is in a psychedelic state. You know, I mean, it really, you know, it takes on these many different dimensions of depth, you know.
But is it more that these shamans, like, more precisely know how to navigate that they know certain types of sounds will bring certain visions? It's not willy-nilly?
Yeah, it's definitely not willy-nilly. And then, you know, I've done this work in Brazil with the Santo Daime, which is this one of the religions that sort of mixes Christianity and indigenous spirituality. And the songs, they've got hundreds of songs that have different kind of purposes and that are parts of different ceremonies. So, yeah, you sing certain songs if you want to kind of bring in a certain type of spiritual being, or another song if you're doing healing, another song if it's just meditation or celebration. So yeah, so it's definitely, you know, I think it's when you work with ayahuasca over time, these songs almost get kind of called out of you in a way. You know?
Yeah, it's just, you're not like thinking, oh, this will be, I feel like doing this song. It just comes, and it just... And it's like, it may be hard to tell if the visions are creating the song or the song is creating the visions, or is it like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that snakes come up a lot in the ayahuasca visions, and these are really pretty important. And you mentioned a book, The Cosmic Serpent, and could you go into that a little bit about why snakes, symbolically or otherwise, are so important with the ayahuasca state?
Yeah, well, snakes definitely can turn up. I've definitely had snake visions. I mean, not all the time. And an anthropologist, Jeremy Narby, was working in, I think, Colombia with the tribe and taking ayahuasca, and he had, you know, some real intense snake visions, and then he began to look at snake visions all around the world, and he developed a very like beautiful and complex thesis. Ultimately, that somehow there's his thesis is that ayahuasca is somehow connected to like the sort of curling DNA coils, and is almost like the DNA has a crystalline structure and projects images. So that he really began to think that ayahuasca was like the kind of consciousness of nature itself communicating with us.
And wasn't there also a Dennis McKenna had a vision with the snakes, and they told him something funny about who's running the planet or something like that?
He had a vision where he became a water droplet going up to the capillaries of a plant and experiencing photosynthesis.
Okay.
But then at the end he was told very, very sternly at the end of his vision that, you monkeys only think you're running this. Definitely.
So, Dennis McKenna and Terrence McKenna, big influences on you. And you had a pretty funny little situation you conveyed in the book where you talked about how you would be real influenced by Terrence McKenna, and then you'd just kind of get away from his whole thought and think it was kind of silly, but you'd get drawn back. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think other people have experienced that with him as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's just a wonderful kind of visionary, a raconteur and sort of spinner of concepts, so he has these concepts about, like, the mushrooms, the psilocybin. He offers the thesis that it's actually a sort of galactic consciousness or galactic civilization. And whereas our perspective that aliens would be kind of in the high-tech spacesuits, and spaceships and UFOs and so on, he argues instead that the mushroom might disseminate itself as spores on meteorites that would crash into planets. And, when they found an inhabitable planet, they would make a kind of symbiotic relationship with, the most intelligent species on the planet and help them develop language and culture and eventually evolve into being kind of a galactic species. And, he really felt, he had this experience in Colombia where the mushroom, he didn't sleep for 10 days and the mushroom was talking to him. And that was basically what it told him, that we were on the verge of making a kind of symbiotic relationship with the psilocybin intelligence to help our species advance to a higher level. So, of course, for most people, that's hard to take. He also had ideas about, he was one of the first people to really delve into this 2012 notion that we're moving towards some kind of global transformation of human consciousness, or what he called the singularity or the eschaton. I guess over time, those ideas, as I've kind of thought more deeply into them, no longer seem as strange to me.
Yeah, I know. McKenna was a big influence on me, and I went to some of his lectures back in the 90s and read his books and all the, had hours of all of his tapes of his bizarre lectures. And I would be, I really kind of had that same experience of where I would just get so immersed in it and just couldn't stop thinking about all his, wild ideas. And then I just kind of drift away for a while and just, your everyday life, it seems to be just hard to mesh that together. And then somehow just getting drawn back again. And it's like that. And
I think maybe some of the ideas are becoming more comprehensible, because in a way our reality on so many levels seems to be becoming both more surrealistic and more psychedelic. We're seeing this incredible... this is really what McKenna kind of prophesied, and also Jose Arguelles, who I write about in my new book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, talked about a kind of acceleration that would take place as we move towards, December 21st, 2012, the end of the Mayan calendar. So it seems like there's, more creation and destruction happening at a faster and faster rate, and more kind of evolution of consciousness happening. So at the moment we're seeing the climate change is accelerating off the charts. I mean, this financial crisis we're having right now is just kind of one of many examples of how things, the systems we've created seem to have, gotten totally out of our control at this point. And somehow, it seems like we're moving towards some kind of threshold where there's going to have to be some kind of movement into new systems,
You had an interesting observation about 9/11 and what that meant related to all of this. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I talk about 9/11 in the new book. I mean, I don't even know if I remember what I said in Breaking Open the Head. But, one thing you could see that the Twin Towers, but I grew up in New York, so I saw them being constructed, and they really changed kind of like the frequency of the city, and you could really see them almost as like a tuning fork, and around that kind of tuning fork, there was this new frequency of kind of predatory global capitalism, the shift from... industrialism to kind of like just a speculation, you know, financially run, you know, speculation. And so them being knocked down like that definitely signaled a kind of a shift in the frequency, you know. And I think that is still something that's like, you know, kind of playing itself out over time.
Yeah, well, I've been actually working with a person on the whole issue of 9/11 and how it was this, you know, very profound event on a lot of different levels, and how tying it in with McKenna's idea about novelty and his time wave zero and plotting this ingression of novelty, and that this was this highly novel event, and that it caused it, you know, history to change in many ways. And that, do you remember McKenna ever talking about the notion of I think he called it the fractal soliton of improbability?
No, that sounds good, though.
I know, it sounds great, yeah. And it was about these improbable events that shouldn't have really happened, but they somehow did, and then it just causes history to go off on this radical tangent. And he said one of those was like the career of Jesus, and that it was like, it was kind of improbable that a character like that would come along and create this religion and everything that came after that, and put us on this totally different track. And I think 9/11 has done that in this notion, if I understand McKenna's idea of the fractal soliton of improbability, when it occurs, it sends these ripples in time backwards and forwards. And if you look, if you really start investigating 9/11, you notice there are really, really bizarre synchronicities going backward and forward in time, of people having, before it occurred, having dreams about it occurring, and then after it, these strange synchronicities, like a baseball game on the third anniversary of it between a team from New York and a team from Pennsylvania on that day of 9/11, the final score of the game being 9-11. At the end of the ninth inning, it was 9 runs, 11 hits for each team. Just really strange synchronicities like that. And are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with those exact examples. I mean, I guess on the one hand, you could say that the World Trade Towers were very improbable. On the other hand, I think, you know, there was a kind of historical inevitability, you know, to it. You know, you know, just a huge amount of pressure, you know, being sort of put on the world, so it's certainly true. There was something about it on many levels, which almost seem kind of occult, you know, or seem to violate kind of normal categories of possibility. I mean, in the new book, I talk about the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University, and they have these, you know, random number generators all over the planet, because we've learned that there's a psychic effect on random number generators, you know, even in, like, casino games and so on.
Yes.
You know, so they keep measuring what happens to these number generators, and they find that when there's a major world event, whether it's like an Olympic event or something, they go off on normal patterns of randomness. So with 9/11, there was the largest deviation from random patterns that they ever recorded. And this deviation actually started several hours before the planes hit the buildings, and then peaked several hours afterwards. You know, so they see that as an indication of somehow humanity beginning to develop a kind of global mind, or a sort of noospheric telepathic awareness.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting how this ingression of novelty, or, you know, the random number generators going off of normal, occurring somewhat before 9/11. So, you know, what was that? Was there maybe that was this really bizarre event of the final stages of the planning of it being, you know, put into effect. So I think that's fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to reading your new book to get some insights about all of that. 2012, the return of Quetzalcoatl,
the Mesoamerican feathered serpent god. Yeah, actually, it's pretty interesting right now because I write in the new book about crop circles, partially, and it's one piece in the book, those patterns that appear in English wheat fields.
Yes.
They can be seen on cropcircleconnector.com is one really great website. There's been actually a number of crop circles this summer that have pointed towards a date, and that date is August 18th, which starts in a few hours. That date is tomorrow. And for instance, there was a crop circle that appeared on August 12th, which just showed the number 6 in Mayan integers. And there were several other ones that suggested lunar cycles a kind of crest on that date. And this has happened before with the crop circles. In 1994, there was a series of them that showed a solar system alignment that was an alignment of planets that was going to happen on a particular date in the year 2000, 6 years later. And when that date in April 2000 came about, it turned out it was one of the largest solar storms in recorded history. And you could actually see the aurora borealis from the UK, which is almost never the case. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens tomorrow.
Okay, well, yeah, we'll definitely be watching for that. And, yeah, this is Robert Larson, and it's KUCI in Irvine, and we're letting the Out the Rabbit Hole show bleed over into the Aggressive Moderate Hour here. And talking to Daniel Pinchbeck, and we've been talking about his book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and we're also getting into his new book, which I haven't read yet, and I will soon, and that is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And your web addresses, again, you want to give those out to us, Daniel?
Yeah, well, one of them is a web magazine that I launched called realitysandwich.com. And actually, we have a nice little article about the crop circles up there now. And then the other one is postmoderntimes.com. That's an animation where we've tried to take some of the ideas from the new book and sort of make them visually compelling and sort of easier to digest.
Okay, so one thing I wanted to ask you is what... You must have some of your friends there in New York who are really much more of the sort of rationalist mindset. I mean, how do they react to what, all these things you're talking about? Do they ever just feel like you've gone off the deep end? Or
Well, I mean, there are definitely a bunch of people who I used to be connected with in like the literary world and the art world here who I'm just not really in communication with anymore, who seem to just think that I've blown a gasket, or in any ways they don't really know how to relate what I'm doing. And then there are other people I know who are even interested in some of this stuff, like psychedelics, but maintain a very skeptical perspective on there being kind of a realm of the psyche or in any kind of global, any possibility of a kind of global consciousness shift or transformation, especially one that would happen in the next few years. And, you know, I started very skeptically, and I feel that I've done my best to kind of, go step by step into my understanding of this stuff. And it's sort of up to the individual to make up their own mind, you know, but you need to have the data before you can even do that.
Well, I think you've behaved like a very good journalist and you're just reporting these things, and then actually some things, how are you going to really report on them if you don't experience them? You know, what can you say about the DMT experience, really, if you haven't experienced it? So, I think you've gone into this in a much more cautious way than say, like Terrence McKenna, you know, we can really praise his work. It's just you have the background as a journalist, and I don't think you really fall out of that, and I think it's great work you're doing.
Yeah, you may change your mind when you read the next book. I kind of segue from journalist into some kind of a philosophy of consciousness or something. I'm really trying to understand what all this stuff suggests, you know.
Okay, well, how are you doing for time, Daniel? I know you were real gracious to stay over into this hour. Can you stay a few more minutes, or how's it going?
We want to do a few more minutes.
If you want to do 10 more minutes or something like
okay.
that.
Okay, yeah. Let's do 10 more minutes. Great.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, it's your Friday night there in New York. But, how do you feel when people say, like something to the effect that you're the new Terrence McKenna? Are you comfortable with that?
Am I comfortable with that? It's a lot better than being the new Timothy Leary, I'll say that much. I guess what I really feel is that there's a there's a much larger movement taking place than just me, and it's really not about any individual person at the moment. It's really about like people coming at it from a lot of different angles, and that's one reason why we started the magazine, because we're really getting a whole, you know, finding people all around the country and around the world who have really interesting stuff to say about this kind of material, about shamanism and, you know, the psyche and so on. I guess I have a role as a communicator, you know, which I'm trying to do my best to perform.
Well, yeah, I want to get a little more into this time thing, and because your newer book, 2012, is obviously gets into that. But to go back into the older book on this time issue, you made this really interesting observation about LSD and when it actually emerged, and could you talk about that, about how this in the whole Nazi Germany sort of arising and that whole horror that we all had to live through, or whoever was alive at that time, and then the LSD coming forth, and then that maybe is not just a coincidence?
Yeah, well, I mean, I even go deeper into it in the second book, but yeah, I mean, definitely the discovery of LSD is a really fascinating story. I mean, there was this chemist, Albert Hofmann, who was working for Sandoz. They were looking at ergot fungus, which midwives had used in Europe to induce muscle contraction. They would also sometimes infect bread and drive people crazy. So they were just looking at it as, what its effects were on muscles. And he was synthesizing the ergot fungus. So LSD was the 25th in a series of syntheses. And didn't really do anything. They put it away. That was in 1938. So then 5 years later, in 1943, Hofmann is in Basel, which is, Switzerland was a little island of neutrality in Nazi Europe. And Basel was also the, historical center of alchemy where Paracelsus taught and so on. So Hofmann just starts having this dream of about the LSD molecule. And so for the first time in his career, he resynthesizes a chemical that didn't really seem to do anything. And somehow, he doesn't even know how, he gets it on his hand inhales it somehow, and has the first LSD trip. And then when he has the first intentional LSD trip, it's the same week that the Nazis have begun the clearing out of the Warsaw Ghetto. So then apparently ergot figures in Kabbalism in some way. So yeah, so it just seems like there's some elements of that story which are highly mystical.
Yeah, and just
chemical,
right? And that, this just couldn't have been coincidence. And we had the Nazism rising in Europe, and this whole horror that was going to occur, and this sort of the bursting forth of the shadow, as Jung would call it, and then you have LSD emerging, and this is a consciousness catalyst, something that's going to probably be necessary to sort of pull us in another direction. And I also think that it's very interesting if you look at the mid-40s, when World War II was ending and the atomic bomb was developed, and we had the mushroom cloud over Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that... McKenna has commented on this, and then it's like, okay, well, we need to be more aware of the psychedelic plant mushrooms, that they can catalyze consciousness in this way we want to go, and they sort of like polar opposite is the nuclear holocaust mushroom. And have you thought much about that?
I've had exactly that thought. But I mean, yeah, McKenna made that observation. Definitely. The way I look at the 60s is as a kind of failed voyage of mass cultural initiation. And, there wasn't the sort of foundation for those kind of experiences that people were having, so it scared people. And, so I think it's possible that, the time we're now, although, most people are not aware of it, I mean, they're on an underground level, since the 60s, a lot of people have... in the West have experienced shamanism and done a lot of work with shamans, and also Eastern mystics. I think there's like a major trend. It's not even a trend anymore. It's really a major cultural shift, which is the integration of Eastern mysticism. Tibetan Buddhism and Vipassana meditation and Zen Buddhism have really become integrated into a lot of modern European and American culture. So I think we've had a major sort of an underground shift in the direction of integrating, shamanism and mysticism and Eastern metaphysics. And so it may be that we're going through a second phase of that initiatory journey, and hopefully it's a phase that has a lot more, we're in a lot more readiness for it. You know, and then if you really look at like what a shamanic initiatory process is, it's a kind of death and rebirth process. You know, you go through this visionary initiation so that you're kind of you've gone through the death state, then you can come back into the world with new knowledge. And I think if you look at what's happening, you know, to the species extinction crisis and climate change and, you know, the sort of mechanistic reality that we've created, you know, we're really, you know, on the verge of that death and rebirth scenario.
We're going through a planetary near-death experience.
Well, it does seem that way. It does seem that way. And you know, we're really going to have to, you know, reach a higher level of consciousness to deal with the cataclysms that we've unleashed on the planet.
And yeah, and then the plant teachers are saying that we are going to need to change, that we're so yeah, 2012. What is supposed to occur in 2012?
Well, I mean, I think that we're going to have to be on the road to creating a compassionate planetary civilization by 2012, which obviously means like a massive paradigm shift from the direction that we're currently going in. And, you know, I think that part of that paradigm shift is going to be, you know, integrating this kind of metaphysical worldview and this consciousness-based worldview. It's kind of like overcoming the ego structure that capitalism has kind of enforced. And, you know, one element of it for me could be, moving in the dimension of psychic energy. I mean, if you look at, and some of this stuff is actually laid out sort of in a mathematical form by different readings of the Mayan calendar. But if you look at the 18th century, you know, when we discovered electricity, you know, we were able, you know, to discover with that new energy that we didn't even know how to use before. I mean, people had seen, like, lightning and experienced shocks. But once we discovered, you know, how to harness electricity, we changed the whole planetary environment in a century and a half. So it may be that we're now on the cusp of, you know, being able to utilize psychic energy for transformation. And once we do that, we might experience like a very, very exponentially accelerated development of our capabilities.
And so the Mayan calendar and people like Terence McKenna with his Time Wave Zero program and others have all seem to have pointed that something seems to be going to go down in 2012, and that there's going to be some radical shift. And I think what you're saying there is that it's up to us what that shift is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the Mayans intentionally like left us a blank page here, and the question is, can we step up to the plate and do the work necessary, like individually and as a society, to deal with what we've unleashed on the planet? And at the moment, I would say it's very unclear if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, would you say that you could actually interpret our present situation, if you look at it at a certain angle, that we're going through somewhat of a compressed dark ages? When you look at, say, things like the war on terror and all of the abuses going on related to that, and just would that feel right to say that to you?
Well, you know, that's one piece of the puzzle, but then another piece is, you know, I could say compressed enlightenment, you know, where like a lot of people are turning on to new information, new ideas. I think what we're really seeing right now is a huge blossoming of personal choice, and it's really up to the individual whether they can step outside of their, you know, kind of ego perspective and container and try to act on a higher level of responsibility and really take responsibility for the global, the planetary situation, and, you know, in the best way they can as an individual.
So like a compressed enlightenment and a compressed dark age is almost going on simultaneously, and then where we need to make that choice, which way it's going to go.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I actually personally have faith that everything is going to, you know, work out okay, although what the mechanisms for that are going to be, it's who knows, you know. But, I mean, I think there's some very encouraging signs in recent history, you know, like the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, you know, and basically, you know, we have all these highly paid people in think tanks and public policy. You know, nobody had predicted or anticipated that wall was going to come down without there being, you know, massive wars and loss of life. You know, so I think on a subliminal level, there's a point where people are just sick of, you know, what's happening. And at that point, you know, change is going to happen.
Okay. You're not particularly troubled by the sort of whittling away of our civil liberties and some of these other abuses that are committed in the name of the war on terror?
Well, in a weird way, I think that those are signs of how close the potential for real liberation is. You know, it's sort of like the system is kind of closing in on itself, and by its own logic, it doesn't even make sense anymore. And that's really the sign of a system that's reaching its final hour. So you know, I think you know, there's a lot of ways you could look at that, but there's, you know, just been a lot of shifts in how value is created by the society, and you know what the internet means as a tool for connecting people and for creating a kind of common ground between individuals and communities. I think that we've never had such a tremendous possibility, actually.
Have you read the book by Paul Levy called The Madness of George W. Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis?
Yeah, I did read that.
Yeah, I thought it had some interesting insights, and he's one of the main things is that he was saying that we are at this point where we have this potential for radical transformation, and that all of what we look at as the darkness is actually a clue that the light is so close by.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, what I'm trying to sort of think about and write about now are really like, you know, what would come next? Like, how could we envision a kind of positive and sort of nonviolent supersession, you know, of the present situation and a movement into something else?
Okay, well, I think that's a really positive note to leave this on, and we'll kind of wrap things up here, and I'll remind the listeners that I'm talking today with Daniel Pinchbeck, and we've been discussing his book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and then we also got into a little bit of his newer book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And if I would be most pleased if you'd agree to be back with us to discuss that book more specifically, Daniel.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, no problem.
Okay, well, we'll set that up, and really appreciate you taking all the time with us today.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. Yeah, and also, as I mentioned, there's a web magazine, Reality Sandwich, that people might enjoy.
Yeah, realitysandwich.com.
Exactly, yeah.
And the other website again?
Oh, it's postmoderntimes.com.
Okay, and your books can be purchased at all the usual places, right?
Yeah, they're on Amazon, at bookstores. I think people will enjoy them, and hopefully they're provide some nice tools to think about the situation we're in.
Okay, well, this has been a really wonderful conversation, and really appreciate you taking the time with us today, Daniel.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Have a great night.
Okay, you too. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, yes, Daniel Pinchbeck, and yeah, you're going to want to check that book out if you like going down rabbit holes and coming back out and expanding your consciousness, and yes, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and yes, the newer book, which I haven't read yet, which I plan to, and then we'll get him back to discuss that, and that is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And yes, so this is Robert Larson, KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.